She happened to be standing at the corner of 3rd and Hiawatha in Minneapolis. Almost any winter Sunday at 1 minute past noon, you're standing right there beside the great iron gates of the Great Northern Railroad. And at 1 minute past noon every Sunday, those great iron gates spring wide open, and amidst the scream of a whistle and the roar of steam, the Empire Builder breaks out of its gates and flashes west across the Great Northern Plains towards Seattle. By sundown, it's flashing across the Dakotas at 120 miles an hour, ripping the great snowdrifts into powdered silver and trailing a long white scarf of smoke against the orange sky. At 1 minute past midnight, it ripped the night wide open with one of those long, eerie, melancholy wails that echoes out across the hills and through the Arctic night. And it snatches one of those long leather pouches from a high signal arm and tosses another similar leather pouch onto the station platform. And then it disappears into the velvet black. Nothing but a little green and yellow light fading into infinity down the track. Well, it leaves behind some things. It leaves behind the click, clickety, click of the telegraph key in that little station. And it leaves behind the blue, white shimmer of the northern lights. And it leaves behind the crunch of a boy's boots chewing the crusted snow. It's 62 degrees below zero. And you've just watched the mail delivered and picked up at Chinook, Montana. I grew up in Chinook. I was second born of seven sons of a tough old Montana pioneer lawyer. Some of you mothers may appreciate it. It isn't easy raising up seven boys, 2 years apart. It takes a big chunk out of a man and woman's life just raising boys. And my dad and mother were determined to raise their boys upright. And they tried a lot of different things. And my dad rejected all those things that didn't hew to a certain path of excellence. And by the time I was in my teens, he had the good lessons all pulled together into four fundamentals. And he applied these four basic fundamentals at work, at play, at study, consistently. He called them the four pillars of pioneer wisdom. And he applied them with discipline. He majored in discipline. And they went like this. The first one was independence and self-reliance. He wanted to make sure that his sons grew up able to stand on their own two feet, not always leaning on a neighbor or borrowing from a buddy or calling out for help from a teacher, but to develop their skills and their willpower so that they could stand alone in life. The second one was persistence and determination. My dad hated a quitter. The third was willpower. He was one of these old-fashioned kind of a pioneer that believed there was something down deep inside a man that separated him from any other living thing, called the human will. He was a Rudyard Kipling buff. He used to have us boys memorize lines and lines of Rudyard Kipling. And he particularly liked those last, near the last lines of Kipling's If, where he says, "My son, hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says, hold on." He was tough, my dad. Loving, tough. The fourth one was enthusiasm. He was a great enthusiast, an up guy, positive, a charger. And of course, that's contagious, particularly to boys. Well, with those four fundamentals, it was easy for me when I got to be 18 to leave that little Montana cattle town and go east to West Point. And there, I fit right into the tough, disciplined, structured military environment. And back there, I found some more of these same kind of tough notions, concepts of life that I had raised up under. But now I found them in more sophisticated form than the philosophy of an old pioneer lawyer. Now I found them in the writings and lectures of Bertrand Russell, Friedrich Nietzsche, Erich Fromm, Ayn Rand. The Fountainhead philosophy was sweeping the great colleges and universities in the East when I went to school. A philosophy that they called in those days dynamic humanism. It really was all pulled together by William Henley long before in the simple lines in his poem where he says, "It matters not how straight the gate or how charged with punishment the scroll, for I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. I." And that's what this philosophy is all about. It says, in effect, that man is the center of the universe. And he's totally responsible for his own life, whether he rises to success or falls. His community, his nation, whether it's the whole sweep of mankind, is man's responsibility. He's alone in the universe. Well, that really is a bold, virile philosophy to teach young 20-year-olds like we were. Because that meant that we could go to the top of the power structure with our own strength, our own skills, our own willpower. We just use the resources we could get our hands on and climb and charge, we could go to the top. And I can remember at West Point thinking, why not? I lived the first year at West Point in the very same room that Robert E. Lee lived in when he was a cadet. He made it. And I tromped the same cobblestones in Central Area in the quadrangle for my demerits that Ulysses S. Grant traveled. He walked the same path for his demerits that I did. And I stood in the same poop deck and called the colors of the day that General Douglas MacArthur did when he was a cadet. He made it. And I sat in the very last seat of the last row of the last section of mathematics that General Dwight D. Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, sat in. He was dumb in math, too. He made it to the top. I could make it, too, with my own skill, my own willpower. If I just persist and develop my skills and hang in there. And I left those four gray walls at West Point in the middle of World War II. D-Day in Normandy, I graduated, 6th of June, 1944. And I went out to the Southwest Pacific as a P-38 pilot. Well, doesn't that impress anybody? Nobody here old enough to remember what a P-38 looks like. But it was a beautiful airplane, silver. Lockheed built it. They called it the Lightning. And it exactly fit this philosophy because it was a fighter. One pilot, one airplane. And you lived or died in the high, thin air over the vast Pacific by how well you developed your skills. With a stick and a rudder and a throttle and a machine gun. And how much guts you could bring to bear in the moment of truth when you were one-on-one behind a zero. And nobody within 100 miles to help you out. And our job out there was to sweep the sky of enemy airplanes so that General MacArthur and Admiral Nimitz could put those great strategic forces to pinch the Pacific together and win the victory. And we were very successful. And every time I shot down an enemy airplane, every time I got a better job or somebody patted me on the back or I got promoted, I'd go into my little tent, and I would sit on my footlocker, and I'd say to myself, "You see, this philosophy works. These other guys around you don't know what they're doing with their lives. Most of them don't care. But you know where you're going, and you know how you're going to get there. Driving hard work, high ethical standards, absolute personal integrity, that's all you know on earth, and all you need to know. And I applied this philosophy day after day, and we swept the sky of enemy airplanes, and we charged up the Western Pacific from island to island. Well, you know the history of the war in the Pacific as well as I do. By the middle of September 1945, General MacArthur and Admiral Nimitz and I had won the war. And we moved into Japan. And we traded in those old war-weary P-38s, and we got the first jets. Remember the very first jets that came to the Pacific? I got command of the squadron. And I kept applying this philosophy with confidence, and I got command of that squadron. Then I got command of a group. I got director of operations of a great wing in Europe when I came home. I got chosen to lead the first jet flight across the Atlantic. Everything seemed to break applying this philosophy that I could do it by myself with my own skill. And every time I'd reach a plateau of success, I'd stop, pause a minute, and say to myself, you see, this is working. You've got the key to life. And then about in the middle of my career, I was a lieutenant colonel. A cloud came out of the sea and crossed my horizon. My eldest son, whom I brought up the same way I'd been brought up, tough, disciplined, self-reliant, he decided to follow in the footsteps of his dad, be a fighter pilot. In fact, he had illusions of grandeur even greater than mine. I was his little league baseball coach. And one day he was sitting on the bench beside me, waiting for his turn at bat, and he nudged me in the ribs with his elbow, and he said, Dad, one of these days I'm going to go by you like a flash in the night. He said, I'm going to be an astronaut. And I patted him on his little baseball cap, and I said, that's nice, son. He said, no, I mean it. I'm going to be the first man on Mars. And you know, that didn't bother me. He was that kind of a boy. Well, he got an appointment to the Air Force Academy. And you know, when the young guys gather at Colorado Springs, the new class in July every summer, they don't know each other. So in order to figure out how they're going to room these young lads, they draw names, you know, to make it fair. My son drew a name and moved in and found himself rooming with a young navigator. Not an airplane navigator. A young Christian. A young Glen Erie navigator. And this young guy had a book that my son wasn't familiar with. He had some ideas about life that my boy hadn't kicked around before. Things like, why am I really here on earth? What am I supposed to be doing with my time here? What constitutes real quality in life, in performance here? And where am I going to go after I'm finished here? You know, sort of basic fundamental questions that my boy hadn't thought much about before. And they used to stay up together, these two guys, late into the night, with a flashlight, far after taps into the night, sharing out of this book. And one day, I got caught by surprise. I got a beautiful, joy-filled letter from my lad. He had become a Christian. Well, I was demolished. I'd taught him all he needed to know to be a success in life. The four principles of pioneer wisdom that my dad had pounded into me, I'd pounded into him. And I wasn't very pleased that he'd run into some young stranger with a book, and after a couple of months had chucked my philosophy in the garbage can. I loved him. He's my eldest son. We'd walked the highways and byways of life hand in hand. So I wrote him a letter. I said, I'm not upset that you found religion. If you don't take it too seriously and keep it in the proper context, it'll help you. Well, my young son, he was an unusually mature young guy. He knew what he had a hold of. So he wrote me back a letter. And he said, Dad, there's no way that I'm ever going to be able to show my appreciation to thank you enough for the good, solid, disciplined way in which you've raised me up in life. But out here in the mountains of Colorado, I've found a young friend with a book that was written by God. And it contains the real truth. And in this book, I have found the key to life. And somewhere, sometime, Dad, you're going to need that key too. Every man does. To unlock your tremendous potential for serving your fellow man. He said, I know it's not yet. But when that day comes, will you remember something? I've found it, and I badly want to share it with you. Well, I didn't have time for that kind of philosophic nonsense. I was charging up the stairway to success in the traditional American Horatio Alger way, by myself, with my own power and wisdom. Charging, scrambling, scratching, hustling day after day, getting tenser and tenser. And of course, this kind of a drive to success takes a military man to war, because that's where the action is. That's where you can really jump ahead of your contemporaries. So I went to Southeast Asia as early as I could, my fourth war. And out there, I commanded a task force for a year and got promoted. Moved into the 7th Air Force headquarters and planned and operated the great interdiction campaign to bomb the supplies coming out of North Vietnam. And at the end of that year, I volunteered to stay on for a third year, my big chance to get promoted to general. And for that volunteering, the air commander gave me the greatest opportunity of my life. Command of the great fighter wing at Tok Lee. Tok Lee and the fighter wing at Tok Lee were way back in the boondocks of Thailand, as far west as you could go, near the Burma border, on the banks of the River Kwai. Remember the bridge across the River Kwai? We had bulldozed out along that riverbank 5 miles of jungle and laid in there a long runway and a package of military power, the likes of which man rarely collects in anger. I had over 100 fighting airplanes in my wing. 5 squadrons of F-105s, fighter bombers, to go bomb and smash the enemy supplies and bridges, trucks. 2 squadrons of tankers, big silver tankers to refuel us in the air. 2 squadrons of electronics reconnaissance airplanes to find the missile sites and the anti-aircraft. And every day I used to lead the dawn patrol, and we would roar out across the Mekong River and find the enemy's supplies, airports, missile sites, bomb and strafe and burn them. And by the middle of that third year, we had set a tremendous record of combat. We were riding a crest of a wave of power and glory. Our esprit de corps was high, our morale was great, our bombing accuracy was terrific. And right in the middle of that third year, President Johnson stopped the bombing. Remember? He came on national television one Sunday afternoon. You probably watched him. And he declared to the world the famous bombing halt. He said, in effect, my pilots are going to stay out of North Vietnam from now on. Instead, we're going to send representatives to Paris. Like civilized human beings should, we're going to sit down with the enemy and reason together, find the basis for peace. Well, out in the war zone, a message came from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Every fighter pilot in the theater was ordered to sit down with his maps on a big navigation table and with a heavy black felt-tip pen carefully draw a line around the border of North Vietnam on his map.
so he would never inadvertently cross the border into North Vietnam, because the president had given his word to the world that we would stay out while those sensitive negotiations were going on in Paris. Well, one day my wing got a tremendously challenging mission, task, to close the great mountain pass at Mujia. Mujia Pass was a cut in the mountains, narrow defile through the mountains between North Vietnam, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and the Mekong River. And through that narrow pass flowed most of the supplies out of North Vietnam and China and Russia, down through the pass and down the Ho Chi Minh Trail and the Mekong River to supply the enemy. Our job was to block the pass. Well, we looked at the aerial photographs, and you could see this narrow cut in the mountains. And up along the northern wall, the northern face of the cliff of the pass, the road snaked, hung high. Very dangerous. Difficult target to hit. But I talked with my pilots, and they convinced me that there was a tactic that would successfully block supplies coming through the pass. If we bombed in on the cliff up above the road and landslid the mountainside down across the road, no way they could get anything through. So this one morning before dawn, we loaded 16 airplanes with 750-pound bombs, our biggest, our toughest bombs. And we set the fuse on the nose to delay so they'd penetrate into the cliff before they exploded. That'd give us more rubble down the mountainside. Well, just as dawn broke over the jungle, we circled over the pass high. And I looked down and I could see this little yellow road snaking through the purple shadows of the dawn. And I called on the radio. Actually, we were on radio silence, but I punched the mic button and I just whispered, "Hang high." That means circle out of sight, and I'll show you where to hit. And I rolled my F-105 over and I dove down into the canyon. At 550 miles an hour, I put the pipper of the sight just above the road on the cliff and held it steady for a second. Then I pickled one bomb. And then I pulled about 5 G's to get up out of the rocks of the canyon and the explosion. And I looked back over my shoulder. Pow! You could see this great white flash down in the canyon. A big explosion. And then after about 10 seconds, it happened. The whole side of the mountain began to shiver and tremble, and then great chunks of granite, karst they call it, stone of the mountainside. Some of the pieces as big as this building broke loose and plunged and bounded down the mountainside, and they ripped out about 50 yards of the road, took it clear to the bottom of the canyon. It was a beautiful hit. So I called again on the radio, and I said, "Okay, you guys, hit my smoke." That means you hit right in there where the smoke's rising, and we'll clean out the rest of the road. Out of the corner of my eye, I caught the flash of a sapphire against the morning sky as my wingman rolled and plunged. At that moment, from across the border in North Vietnam came a great storm of red balls of anti-aircraft fire, and they hit him. He was on fire. He began to smoke. Well, I had to get him out of there. He was my responsibility. So I tucked him under my wing in close formation, and we fled down across the Mekong River Valley, trailing fire and smoke, pieces of aluminum and steel falling off his airplane, frantically looking for an emergency base to get him on the ground quickly. And we found the long concrete runway at Ubon in Thailand, just across the Mekong River in friendly territory. And he landed there. But as he popped his drag chute to slow down, he exploded. Oh, a great orange and black ball of boiling fire on the runway. Well, we got him out of the wreckage, and we raced him to the hospital at Ubon. But I could see, looking down there at him in the emergency room, he was in serious condition, all black, deep burn, charcoal all over. Well, I stumbled out of the operating room and across the street down toward the flight line. And as I came up to my airplane, there was a roar overhead. And I looked up. There they were, my flight. They'd completed closing the pass, and they were on their way west toward our base at Takli, far to the west. And the thought crossed my mind, you've got to follow them home. But I didn't. I was so consumed with hatred and anger, bitterness. I strapped on my parachute, I blasted my afterburner, and I took off east. I crossed the Mekong River, and I climbed and crossed the Great Mountains. And I didn't turn. I crossed the North Vietnamese border, too. And I found that anti-aircraft site. And with all my remaining bombs in one savage attack, I smashed it. Smashed all their guns, burned all their supplies. Well, of course, a great pillar of fire and smoke boiled up out of the jungle. You could see it for 100 miles away. And the little light airplane that had been assigned to check how well we'd closed the road in the past, he also saw this great explosion and fire over in North Vietnam. And he knew that was a mistake. So he made a special radio report to the command post in Saigon. Well, I flew home and landed at my base at Dock Lee, my home base. But as I came out of the revetment area, my executive officer was coming toward me. And he said, "Boss, the general wants to talk to you on the telephone." So I walked into the command post and I tossed my parachute on a chair. I picked up the phone. It was the general. He said, "Bottomley, did you just lead a strike in Mujia Pass?" I said, "Yes, sir. We closed the pass." He said, "I have a strange report here on my desk. Apparently you made some kind of a mistake. Some of your bombs inadvertently blew across the border into North Vietnam." He said, "That's going to be very embarrassing to General Abrams and myself, a disaster, unless you can explain it." I said, "General, it was no mistake. They fired across the border in violation of the no-bombing agreement, and they probably killed one of your finest pilots, one of my best friends. So I retaliated." Well, my boss was one of these unusually quiet, calm, low-key, unflappable, a real gentleman, but articulate. And But in order to make absolutely sure that every pilot in this theater appreciates what I mean by air discipline, that young lad was court-martialed. He's now serving 2 years in the penitentiary at Fort Leavenworth. He said, "You're suspended from command, but stay close to a telephone. I'll shortly tell you where your court-martial will convene." Instant disaster, right? All those years of driving and charging and hustling and struggling up the stairway to success, demolished. This philosophy over which I had a grip on every situation that presented itself with my own skill power and my own willpower, atomized. Even my personal freedom, gone. I couldn't believe it. how at dawn one morning I could walk out to my airplane, the greatest hero in the war, or I thought I was, and before noon I'm at the bottom of a pit. I walked around for 3 days in a growing depression of gloom and doom, disaster. I couldn't eat. My stomach was tied up in a knot, anxiety, waiting for the telephone to ring. I couldn't sleep. I'd try to close my eyes and the inside of my eyelids would flash through the kaleidoscope of images. I could see prison bars clanging shut. There was a ringing in my ear, a beat in the back of my head. Finally, after 3 days of this, exhausted, I stumbled into my little hooch. There was a chair holding the door ajar to keep it cool inside, and I slumped down into the chair, and my head fell forward into the palms of my hands, and I just sat there. I don't know how long. I remember one time with all my strength raising up my head and heaving a great hopeless sigh. And then my head fell back into my hands. And then in the quiet shadows of that little hut, an amazing thing began to happen. All those images and sounds that had been driving me for over 48 hours began to quiet down, slow down, kind of fade out. And there against the sort of black velvet screen of the inside of my mind, I found myself looking directly into the quiet face of my Christian son. A clear image. And it hung there on the screen of my mind. It wouldn't go away. It persisted. And I said to myself, somebody is trying to tell you something. So I knocked the telephone off its cradle and I asked the Bangkok operator to get a hold of my son. He was at Purdue now. Purdue University. He'd graduated from the Air Force Academy. He was taking his master's degree at Purdue in Indiana. And amazingly enough, in about 5 minutes, he came up on the telephone. And I told him what a disaster had struck down his old dad, right at the peak of my career.